We'll move again then. Well, it gives me a great pleasure to welcome Kriti Kapila from the Indian Institute at King's in London. Kriti's an anthropologist. In the past, she's worked on a number of things, tribals and urban anthropology as well. But her special interest recently has been in the law, and she's going to give us a paper on popular justice, law, and the inexpediency of culture in North India. Kriti, thank you very much.
Thank you, David, for your introduction. And before I begin, I want to express my thanks to two people who are not here. One is Professor Bailey for this invitation, and also to my sister, Shruti Kapila. So two absent friends, but thank you for coming on a glorious day like this and indulging me for the next while. So this paper is not really about cups. So people who've come to hear about cups, I apologize at the outset. It is going to talk about cups, but it isn't going to explain what they are. So on the 13th of April 2010, over 7,000 people representing roughly 115 North Indian caste councils, or CUP panchayats, attended a meeting in Kurukshetra in the state of Haryana in North India. The meeting was widely reported in the national and local media and was called by these councils to protest against the verdict of a local court, indicting one such caste council in a case of so-called honor killing. Earlier in March 2010, a sessions court in Karnal, Haryana, had awarded death penalty to five persons for the murder of Manoj, 23 years old, and Babli, 19, in 2007, who had been killed for marrying within the same Gotra or descent group. The Karnal court passed the death sentence for five members of Babli's family for carrying out these murders, and a life sentence for the head of the Kha Panchayat who had ordered these killings. The court judgment and the ensuing meeting in Kurukshetra were new salvos from two old enemies in a bid to break out of a deadlock that had been festering for more than 2 years at the time. In the course of this time, a growing number of young men and women had been killed by their kin at the behest of similar diktats issued by caste elders as retribution against mismarriages between men and women, either of the same gotra and or of the same village or across the Dalit Savarna divide. Through the Karnal court judgment, the state had finally showed a categorical sign of disapprobation for this form of runaway justice. The Kurukshetra meeting proved to be so popular that in the next few months, several such congregations were convened. Here, thousands of ordinary and not so ordinary men and women from across the North Indian plains gathered as members of or supporters of caste councils, giving further evidence to the growing unassailability of CUPS. Both the killings of young men and women and supporting congregations of or these Mahapanchayats attracted a fair deal of media frenzy and have since then become subject of growing scholarly attention. In a curious development, the spate of murders gave to the swift import of the appellation of honor killings, the spate of in media and popular representations. This was perhaps a nod to the global imaginary in which India exists not only as a dominant economic player, but also one in which India too is plagued by the same irritants as its global comrades. That is, by certain lumpy bits of culture, not that those bits that make for heritage, but those that ostensibly lead to clashes of civilizational proportions. Culture in this instance was identified with caste, and scholarly, journalistic, and civil society attention elaborated on the underlying caste and gender dynamics that informed this brutal form of popular justice in North India. In most of these accounts, the persistence of an older jurisprudence was seen to be epiphenomenal of an underlying obduracy of a region to become progressive and its inability to inculcate desired social reform. Commenting on the phenomena in the national press, historian Prem Chaudhary, who has probably written most extensively on CUPS, said, "You cannot do away with CUPS because they are old institutions, but I would suggest that they take on reformist agenda. CUPS have to reform," she said, highlighting at once the reading of the situation, even by an expert like her, through a premium of change. This is particularly curious given that Chaudhary has herself noted the shifting interests of CUPS in the course of the last century, including their once patently reformist concerns, such as opprobrium against lavish expenditures at weddings and or demands for exorbitant dowry. She herself observed, it is significant that in the colonial period, leaders had activated caste reform movement in their move towards upward mobility. In the post-colonial period, the same affluent groups are apparently still theoretically committed to purging the worst social abuses, end of quote. For Chaudhary then, reform is merely a matter of political expediency. In the 2010 interview in a popular news magazine, she argued that CUP leaders have abandoned the reformist agenda because it no longer carries any political purchase. She reads their adoption of stricter observance of caste stricture as an expeditious route to influencing popular sentiment because it is an emotive issue on which they can mobilize. That is Chaudhry. However, no explanation is either offered by her or indeed sought by the interviewer as to why or how stricture has come to entail an emotional appeal for some in North India at this time. As is evident from the trajectory of the concerns outlined by Chaudhry, the rise of the CUPs in the last few years is not due to an obduracy of a culture that refuses to change, were that to be true for any culture. Rather, the recent ascendance of CUPs and their efficacious violence is precisely a result of a tectonic shift in local society and culture, none of which was either cognized or indeed anticipated. The clue to this shift lies in the choice of the adversary singled out by CUPs. Caste patriarchs had not identified romantic love, nor indeed individual choice, as a root cause of their outrage, as has been hastily and erroneously surmised by commentators and critics. In specifying the Hindu Marriage Act of 1955 and its sub-clause pertaining to the same Gotra marriage, these councils have declared substantive state law as their direct adversary, indicting it for making possibilities that were not scripted within culture. This contest between culture and cultural and legal norms is not unique to India, and in fact forms the bedrock of identity politics that scholars from divergent traditions and persuasion have written extensively about. Whilst the inseparability of law from culture is undisputed, there remain significant differences of how the relationship is understood and explained for different contexts. Euro-American socio-legal scholarship tends to subsume the two into one on the grounds of a purported consensus between law and culture, in that law is but a codification and reinscription of everyday life, values, and life ways, or in other ways, culture. The tension between the two domains is acknowledged and understood by some to originate in the force of state power behind law. This tension gains new life forms every now and then, and its most contemporary manifestations have been, for example, the debates surrounding the illegalization of the headscarf in France, or the conflict between notions of human rights and certain cultural practices, for example, female circumcision in certain African communities living in Europe. In these accounts, the gap between law and culture is in the Euro-American context is sourced to a cultural heterogeneity that seems to have arisen from the fact of immigration. That is to say, normative difference is understood to emerge, if not lie, outside of society. The scholarship on the relationship between law and culture in Euro-America, while is important and insightful, is ultimately of limited use for understanding the relationship between culture and law in India for two reasons in the main. First, because unlike Euro-American law, it is arguable to what extent state law in India draws on everyday social values. In fact, it may be more accurate to say that in India, legal and cultural norms far from coincide. Therefore, the subject of law and that of culture, broadly defined, often appear in contradistinction with each other. The relationship between the two is not necessarily one of hostility, but rather the public aspirations of law in India are aimed at attaining the eventual coincidence of the two in some unforeseen future. Secondly, the source of the heterogeneity between cultural and legal norms in most multicultural states in Euro-America is seen to be located in an externality or a separation achieved in the fact of either settler colonialism, I'm thinking here of the first, the Aboriginal rights in Australia, First Nations theory in North America, or through immigration, i.e. most work on Islamic radicalism ranging from the Salman Rushdie fatwa to the illegality of the headscarf in France. Therefore, it is minimally plausible in these contexts to constitute culture as a problem when culture stands in for a shorthand for normative heterogeneity. In India, however, cultural difference is seen intrinsic to the self-image of society in India. Unity and diversity is the most often repeated state slogan, and it is law that is seen to have the position of the emigre. This distinctive nature of the relationship between law and culture in India has thus far been inadequately explored. Situations such as the current standoff between CUPs and the state judiciary tend to become natural citizens of analytical subcultures such as legal pluralism, and often fall prey to our habits of thinking about such domains. Through a counterfactual reading of the relationship between law and culture in contemporary India, I want to explore the constitution of culture as a problem, as an impediment in the work of law in India in two distinct moments in North India, and its implication for understanding the overlaps between culture and legal subjectivity today. The current conflict between law, state law and popular justice bears an uncanny resemblance to a contest in the region witnessed through the second half of the 19th century. The North Indian plains posed a special problem to the colonial state with respect to the question of law, both in terms of the rules by which people lived their lives, as well as the processes and particular institutions for dispute settlement. For the best part of 50 years following the annexation of Punjab in 1846, the then colonial state vacillated on how to contain the influence of local councils and custom and gain force and authority behind its own laws. From 1846 to 1899, the colonial government in Punjab went back and forth on the legal recognition of local juridical institutions or village panchayats. These councils or village elders adjudicated on local disputes, but in places the role of the panchayat was more varied, so that they were also responsible for collecting and keeping important non-revenue records. In the hill districts of Kangra and Kullu, for example, specialist councils maintained records of marriage payments and whose approval was necessary in the annulment of marriages and in transfer of marriage payments in case of remarriages for women. The colonial state viewed these panchayats with great skepticism, but for a host of reasons found it difficult to either ignore them or to get rid of them altogether. The process of instituting any credible form of colonial legal government in the region was a long drawn out one which both tested and at the same time helped to articulate the state's disposition towards the culture question. When Punjab was first annexed in 1846, in a move to signal the advent of a new regime, all panchayats were summarily made illegal across the province, and people were encouraged to take their disputes to the newly instituted state courts. But this was not as straightforward as the state might have initially anticipated. In the first decade of the colonial rule in Punjab, the new laws and institutions proved either too unpopular, such as in the northwest frontier province, where Jirga or tribal councils held sway, or too popular and thereby becoming inundated by the volume of litigation, such as in the sea settlage areas. The sea settlage areas were the first to witness a surge in the value of land as a result of spread of irrigation. At the same time, growing and unprecedented levels of rural indebtedness gave rise to large-scale unregulated transfers of land, resulting in high volumes of litigation. While there was complete non-recognition of the juridical authority of the state by the people in the northwest frontier province, in the case of sea settlage areas, the state's inadequacies to deal with the consequences of its own policies and interventions were first revealed at the level of institutions. In order to tide over the crisis of legitimacy as well as a growing litigiousness, panchayats were made legal again in 1869 and were given responsibility for adjudicating on local disputes. But the challenge posed by the shared juridical authority did not go amiss, and they were once again made illegal in 1899 on the grounds of their processual opacity and lack of moral integrity, thus deepening the gulf between the domains of state law and prevailing cultural norms. The government tried to address this gulf through a two-pronged solution. It first put in place resources to extend the state judicature to every locality. More entry-level courts in towns and kasbas were created in order to increase the reach of and access to state judiciary. The expansion of the judiciary was accompanied by the appropriation of local jurisprudence within the state juridical regime. It also resulted in the recognition of panchayats as and where they existed and allocated to them the jurisdiction over certain kinds of affairs that were deemed customary. This required, of course, clarifying and codifying what was meant by customary. The incorporation of local jurisprudence within the state juridical framework led to the inscription and codification of local norms and practices in compendia of rules and regulations used by the state courts for jurisprudence prudential references. In other parts of British India, such matters were the subject of personal law or governed by religious tenets. But the area that stretched from northwest frontier province to Delhi was recognized as a region where religious codes did not necessarily find resonance in the habits of people. It was said, the Punjab is unique in one particular respect. The primary rule of civil judicature as to all the all-important personal relations and to the rights of property and land amongst rural classes who form the bulk of the population is customary law, and not as elsewhere in India, the Hindu and Mohammedan laws, which here are of secondary importance, though these also have to be administered. Since tribal, community, and local rules were seen to have greater influence, the state found it necessary to systematize these local laws. There was great debate on whether the axis of variability of custom lay at the level of group or at the level of territory. In keeping with the ethnological imagination of the time, the locus of culture was seen to be territory, and therefore district-wise manuals of customary law were compiled for the use of jurisprudential reference in the adjudication of disputes. These manuals remained in use until the Constitution came into force in 1950. In collecting and publishing several compendia of local customary laws, the state once again signalled the discrepancy and the distance between legal and cultural norms. Even more importantly, it abjured its responsibility in resolving this dissonance by separating out two distinct realms of influence. While it, the colonial state, was to hold sway over matters of general interest and criminal activity, other matters that were deemed of ordinary occurrence, such as marriage and inheritance, were to be governed by people's own rules, a convention that continued till independence. The existence of parallel jurisdictions of state, religious, and customary law made for opportunistic assumption of variable subject positions by Punjab litigants, and typically in colonial Punjab, people tended to litigate on the basis of the most expedient jurisdiction in for their case. The colonial state thus addressed the question of culture in the region by first recognizing it as custom and contained its realm of influence by its incorporation within state law. The relationship between law and culture changed once again when the Constitution came into force after independence, and particularly with the promulgation of the Hindu Marriage Act and Succession Act in 1955 and 56, respectively. All matters hitherto regarded as of ordinary occurrence or customary were brought under one single jurisdiction and all India law. This move towards achieving legal universalism as an important strategy for nation-making has been examined to some extent with respect to the debates surrounding the incommensurability between uniform civil and personal codes. However, its effects on the structuring principles of North Indian society has yet to receive any systematic attention, to which I now turn. The Hindu Marriage Act of 55 and Succession Act of 56 are fragmentary and watered-down version of a more radical, comprehensive Hindu code bill, the promulgation of which had caused much political and social upheaval. The two acts were feared for the rupture they were potentially going to cause within Hindu society. Most notably, whilst the Hindu Succession Act came to be opposed for its potential to alter the bonds between brothers and sisters, once a sister became a right holder in a native property, the Hindu Marriage Act was seen by some merely license indiscriminate sexual activity and therefore as a threat to existing moral values. These and other capacity of the acts to reform, reshape, reorder Hindu society have been scrutinized by scholars for their role in changing household composition, the project of nationalism and development, and gender relations in post-colonial India. Though these studies are diverse in their emphasis and persuasion, they hold in common a sociological or a socio-historical reading of these acts and their effects on Hindu society. Due to this, while they illuminate the changed nature of the Hindu household and the gendered character of the nationalism and indeed post-colonial development, they're unable to throw light on the structural features of their effects. I suggest that shifting the vantage point from the sociological underpinnings and manifestations of these acts to their entailed anthropology of kinship and personhood allows us an aperture on unexamined aspects of the relationship between law and culture in contemporary India. When the colonial state marked out a legally distinct sphere called the customary, it at once signaled the gap between cultural and legal norms, as well as its inability or disinclination to resolve the tension arising from that gap. The post-colonial life and the status of that gap is of an entirely different order, in that it has remained mostly unacknowledged. It is noteworthy that the Constituent Assembly did not consist of a single member who either was mandated or then advocated the recognition of customary or local laws, or indeed dharmashastras or classical legal texts. In staying close to the motto of unity and diversity, constitutional law acknowledged the heterogeneity in matters of ordinary occurrence by promulgating religion-based personal codes along with the homogeneous All India Civil Code. The primary site of difference thus came to be religion, and variability along the axis of legality did not find recognition within constitutional jurisprudence. This not only meant the non-recognition of colonial customary law, but also the North-South divide in kinship rules. The prevailing hope was, over time, familiarity with new legal institutions as well as new legal norms would end in closing this gap and the emergence of a new legal consciousness, which is more in consonance with the new ideals. This ostensibly non-interventionist approach was part of a more general disposition of optimism surrounding the fate of the post-colonial national community and the advent of modernity that was not restricted to the domestic realm. The then 10-year time frame for reservations, the non-enumeration of caste in successive censuses, the apathy of the political left towards matter of religion are but some prominent examples of the hopes vested in the promise of state-driven modernity on the one hand and of salutary disregard of the culture question on the other in independent India. It is this non-intervention and non-acknowledgement of the conditions created by the diluted Hindu Code Bill that can be seen as a genesis of the most recent battle between law and culture that CAPS are currently waging, as I next outline. So gender and family are regarded as the major axes of reform that Hindu Marriage Act of 1955 and 66, Succession Act of 66, both by lawmakers and in scholarship. By outlawing polygamy and by introducing the legal possibility of divorce amongst all Hindus, including upper caste men and women, the Hindu Marriage Act radically altered the legal legibility of the Hindu conjugal unit. But in terms of kinship, it was the Hindu Succession Act that was the more significant of the two. It gave primacy to the conjugal unit as opposed to the joint household composed of male collaterals in succession, and for the first time bestowed on women the right to inherit property as equal heirs, whether as wives or as daughters. As is evident, this was a completely new way of imagining not only how wealth and property were to be held, distributed, and devolved in the family, but more significantly, how people must relate to one another within and outside kinship. These laws were formulated to usher in, as it did indeed, a new society underpinned by a firm belief in equity and equality, where gender and family relations needed to undergo radical reform. The sites of reform were not new per se. But what distinguished these acts from similar efforts undertaken either by colonial officials or indeed by anti-colonial nationalists was the scale and scope of transformation entailed in these. These were not examples of piecemeal legislation targeted at isolated social practices, be that sati, widow remarriage, age of consent, land alienation, etc., but were a very conscious and comprehensive rewriting of the grammar of relatedness in North Indian society. The intent of these two acts was not misplaced, but the rhetoric on which their promulgation was premised deeply influenced the nature of their unfolding in subsequent years in at least two important ways, neither of which has been examined sufficiently, either in public debate or indeed in scholarship. First, the Hindu Code Bill and the eventual two acts gave the appearance of giving birth to a new coda to arrange matters of daily occurrence. This was not altogether a false appearance, for these were indeed new ways of imagining the working of a Hindu household. However, these acts had indirectly drawn on classical legal texts, as some scholars have shown, or at least on upper caste sensibilities. The iteration of newness was understandable because asserting rupture with the past was rhetorically necessary to ensure the success of the reformist agenda. But rupture and its attendant rhetoric disallowed an explicit tackling of the culture question, and in particular its relationship to law, even in a germane moment like that presented in the debate surrounding the Code Bill. Secondly, the state and law by extension did not have any discursive or political ground to articulate its disengagement from or disavowal of the culture question. This was because, unlike the colonial state, independent India could hardly claim non-intervention on the ground of an ostensible sovereignty of the domestic sphere, contra Chatterjee. In the all-encompassing self-image of unity and diversity, there was no aspect of culture that could be disavowed as not one's own by the nation state. To do so would imply and undermine sovereignty of the nation state. Moreover, these new laws were couched less in the spirit of non-intervention and more in the belief in reform. Therefore, aspects of custom or culture by extension had to be either declared repugnant and or outmoded and derecognized, as in the case of polygamy, or had to be sidestepped altogether in non-acknowledgement and non-recognition. The notion of reform was key here, for it produced the acts as a deliverance of the anti-colonial agenda and could thus be deployed to battle the contrarians with unassailable legitimacy. As a result, culture begot a fudging in post-colonial law, and both in its content and its force, particularly in relation to law, were never explicitly dealt with or indeed resolved. This non-acknowledgement and non-resolution of the gap between cultural and legal norms in domestic matters had a profound and more fundamental effect in the following decades, the roots of which lay in the new generative grammar of Hindu relatedness in these two acts. While the Hindu Marriage Act reduced the conjugal unit to a monogamous one, the Hindu Succession Act reconfigured the principles and patterns of inheritance and also reimagined familial relations from the vantage point of new heirs. The legal categories of kin produced in and through these acts, wife, son, sister, bore at best nominal resemblance to their cultural counterparts, not least because in their transcription of kinship terminology, the prevalent descriptive kinship system was rendered into a classificatory one, i.e. in India we have a separate term for every single kin relationship, whereas these are generic terms, that's a classificatory term. All uncles and all aunts and all brothers and all sisters, there's nothing distinctive in any of this. The new laws failed to produce the complexity of relationality that is fundamental to kinship. These changes were not merely of academic import, especially when these new forms of sociality and society combined with prevailing dominant norms in the new structuration of North Indian society. The consequences were entirely unanticipated and went mostly unacknowledged. The models of the family and household inherent in these acts were borrowed from their Western counterparts that bore a deep agnatic bias. The motor of Hindu society, on the other hand, is primarily driven by alliance rather than descent. Much of the work in culture and society in India revolves around a horizontal axis rather than a vertical one, arranging marriages, keeping and marking ritual distance, etc. Marriage is not only the central feature of kinship structures in India, but the very nature of this work is intimately connected to the production of principles of caste hierarchy. As Louis Dumont writes, marriage dominates the Hindu social life and plays a large part in his religion. It is the most prestigious family ceremony, and at various social levels constitutes the main occasion on which the greatest number of members of the caste and persons gather together. By its very nature, marriage constitutes to a large measure the link between the domain of caste and that of kinship. Thus, in North India, the production of kinship and hierarchy are intimately linked. Furthermore, as Dumont remarks elsewhere, in North India, the twin interdictions between the reversal in the direction of exchange of women and against patrilateral cross-cousin marriage are logical elaborations of a wider principle of caste hierarchy. Caste invades the sphere of kinship in such a way that we cannot speak with any rigor of a kinship system as such, he writes. The hypergamous model replaces a kinship element that allows the whole to keep a similar form. End of quote. For these reasons, it is impossible to disentangle structures of kinship from those of caste in North India, and any reform aimed at one will have implications on the other. So it was in the case of the Hindu Code Bill and its derivative acts. Based in the commitment to the wider principle of equality underpinning the Constitution, the Hindu Succession Act and Marriage Act had a deep effect not just on the structure of North Indian kinship, but on its very foundational principles. In making the newly narrowed conjugal unit and its direct descendants as primary heirs to property and bestowing them with ownership of hitherto unavailable equal dispositional rights, the Hindu Marriage Act and Succession Act altered the principles of relationality in North India and at once reversed the motor of Indian society. In their unfolding, the two acts grammatically altered North Indian kinship from a kinship system from a descriptive one to a classificatory one, and shifted its motive from alliance and placed an unprecedented weight on descent. The clue to these shifts is to be found in a number of changes that have taken place in North India, and are sometimes too easily and hastily explained away by bulky rubrics like modernity, globalization, Sanskritization, etc. The effects of this shift, coupled with the fact that it went largely unacknowledged and unarticulated, are altogether profound, and as in the case of cups, even violent, as the next section, as the next bit of the paper now elaborates. Let us remind ourselves of what is at issue for us as far as the cups or caste councils are concerned. In the main, cups have increasingly gained force by issuing retributory diktats against bad marriages or mismarriages, whether it be intercaste, endogamous, or intralocal, none of which is an invalid form of marriage in the eyes of the law. In addition, these councils of patriarchs have petitioned the Indian state to amend the Hindu Marriage Act to reflect the demands. What is posed as a special challenge to the state is their growing popular and political influence and the perpetration of violence at their behest. Let us also remind ourselves about the region where the cup panchayats are most influential and where the rate of the so-called honor killings is on the increase. The region comprises mainly of Haryana, Western Uttar Pradesh, and Delhi, and has been marked by at least two distinct waves of affluence in the last 50 years, both of which are tied to the increasing value of land. In the first instance, the region was amongst the primary and significant beneficiaries of the Green Revolution in the 1950s and 60s that saw an unprecedented growth in the rural economy of the area and a section of the rural population flushed with new wealth. Commentators have elaborated on the relationship between economic growth and new sociological developments, in particular the dwindling sex ratio in the region, which currently stands at an abysmal 850 girls for every 1,000 boys. The rise of cap violence is thus also sometimes attributed to the paucity of young women in the region of marriageable age. However, neither the adverse sex ratio nor the phenomena of large proportion of young men of marriageable age being unmarried in this region is an entirely recent development, and that both these features of North Indian society are linked to the rising value of land, which is, you know, which goes beyond the 50 years, and of rising political power of landowners. I want to suggest that although very important, political economy alone cannot explain the rising influence of cap violence, as we witness today. The changes taking place in the structuring principles of North Indian society need to be paid attention to. The reversal of the motor of society from alliance to dissent has had a profound effect in this area, I suggest. The work of society has shifted in that there is a new emphasis placed on dissent as opposed to alliance. This does not imply that the work of alliance has been altogether abandoned, but that social institutions and efforts are now geared more towards achieving the objective of producing dissent rather than alliance. Thus, from arranging marriages or circulating women as a motor of moving society forward, increasing its thickness and intensifying the density of relations, the new laws have managed to engender a recalibration of this effort so that the focus is heavily weighed in favor of producing heirs, or in other words, descendants. As a result, social value is no longer being produced simply in and through establishing or reinforcing horizontal networks of alliance, but is now being contested, if not superseded, by its production along the vertical axis of descent. The evidence is most clear from the key shift in this area, where the region's well-established male child preference has achieved an ever sharper edge in the preceding decades. The need to produce male heirs has now achieved an unprecedented level of autonomy so that it becomes a goal in itself, i.e. freed from conjugality. Social and reproductive technologies have aided it when freeing from the conjugal complex. And even though the Hindu Succession Act produces sons and daughters as equal as or descendants, these technologies, along with the policy imperative two-child norm, have combined only to further the dominance of the male child preference. But what is interesting and to an extent remains unaccounted for is that the scarcity of women in the event of the lowered sex ratio has not yielded in a change, if not reversal, in the traffic and direction of marriage payments, as might have been hoped with an anthropological logic, if not presumed. Rather, in a bizarre development, two forms of marriage have resurfaced after nearly a century: marriage by abduction or capture, and child marriage. The form of development, or marriage by abduction, is now nearly a decade old, and technically not really a marriage, in that it is a contractual renting of the womb of women abducted from places as far away as Bangladesh for the explicit purpose of producing a male heir, whose services are most likely to be terminated once the mission is accomplished. The abductee has no rights in that household beyond the agreed payment for childbirth. Child marriage, on the other hand, is being touted by cap patriarchs and even by some social services as the preferred solution to producing the right kind of male heirs, as well as a solution to keeping the circulation of women, young women, in control. In this complex, the paucity of women in the community, which should have led to an increase in their value, a change some might have hoped for, and possibly an eventual reversal in the direction of marriage payments, is nearly impossible to come into being. In the end, gender, that much-wanted axis of reform, and the vector of domestic equality enshrined in the Hindu Court Bill and the subsequent Marriage and Succession Acts, does not, and dare I say, cannot or will not correct its imbalance in the long run. The reason for this lies in the way social reform and its axes were envisaged in this law, to which I now turn. In discussing the relationship between law and culture thus far, I have addressed some of the strategies and conditions through and under which culture and cultural practices have challenged the legitimacy of the Indian state in recent times. If community and patriarchs have found culture as a conduit to assert their political and social clout by taking on the law or demonstrating its alien qualities, Then in this war of attrition, law on its part has reasserted its position as being a prosthetic extension of the paternalistic Indian state. In such a self-positioning, law becomes and presents itself not just as an arbiter or a guarantor, but also as a provider of all things that culture could not or did not provide. Chief amongst these are the rights of equity and equality, hitherto unavailable to the citizenry, at least in and through culture. In doing so, law becomes a critical medium through which the framework of right becomes the lingua franca for comprehending not just political but social life as well. But as Marilyn Strathern has cautioned us, it is imperative to denaturalize the language of rights, for, I quote, a vocabulary that turns on the deprivation of rights must entail premises about specific forms of property. To assert rights against others implies a sense of legal ownership, end of quote. Imputed in this framing of itself as a provider of all that which is lacking elsewhere is by necessity a restrictive constitution of all sources, other sources of social and political life. Seen from the eyes of law, culture in this all too powerful framework then becomes a restriction, one that constrains people from realizing the full potential of rights and liberties conferred in and through citizenship. Speaking within this framework or in its support, 60 years after the Constitution first came into force, at such moments of serious challenge from the other side, law and its liberal defendants wittingly or unwittingly position culture as a thief, as one that takes away from society all that which law has bestowed on it. In a neat reversal, law becomes the giver of the gift of rights to citizens, and culture becomes a thief or misappropriator. If we locate theft in the realm of exchange, then it sits at odds with gift, in fact, almost in opposition to it. Gifts propel exchange, but in as much as exchange is written into the gift, so is the grayness of ownership. Theft, on the other hand, disrupts exchange, calls a halt to it, momentarily disturbs the logic of flow, precisely because it disputes and appropriates ownership, not through a process of exchange, whether equal, reciprocal, or asymmetric, but by its disruption, its end. It seeks to end the grayness of ownership to bring it within the realm of black and white clarity. The theft of rights, then, is the greatest crime committed by culture, for it stops certain forms of symbolic exchange, in this case, the rights and obligations between the state and citizens, to continue or even come into being at all. But what kind of theft, if any, does law commit on culture? It is here that Strathern's caution comes to bear upon the argument. To talk of rights that law has bestowed and which subsequently culture takes away in the event of efficacious carp violence is to first avert to the existence of those rights in the first place, and the location of these rights in the form of legal ownership people have in themselves and with regard to other people. It is when the edifice of rights talk is placed apart at this angle that the consequences of the original non-acknowledgement of culture by law becomes evident. Indian law recognizes culture and cultural difference in very particular forms. The greatest acknowledgement of cultural difference recognized and defended by the Constitution is at the level of religion, and the existence of various personal codes are proclaimed as testimony to the defense of difference by law in India. It is another matter that its impetus is derived not so much as recognition of difference, but from the constitutional guarantee to the right to equality. But what needs to be underscored in the constitutional guarantee of personal codes is the swift and sealed conclusion that the recognition of difference has been completed or is complete in this one step. The optic of spirit level that pervades the Indian legal imagination deems that anything that is different can and must be seen, always be seen as that which needs to be brought up to the level playing field. For example, in the landmark overturning of the High Court overturning of Article 377 of the Indian Penal Code, that criminalized homosexuality since colonial times, the judgment was based on the defense of legal minorities, in this case sexual minorities, rather than a right to difference per se. This numerical and statistical idiom of equality in Indian law is well noted, but what remains under-theorized is its monadic as opposed to relational calculus of subjectivity. As in the case of the Marriage Act and Succession Act, the law purports to suffuse the individual with rights and obligations, but does so in a unitary or atomistic fashion, so that it is the event or the becoming or unbecoming of that kind of person, i.e. when they become wife, heir, daughter, widower, divorcee, that becomes the focus of juridical attention and elaboration, leeching away from it the complexity entailed in the relationship per se. The husband-wife relation, for example, is not just a relationship between the man and woman, but also encompasses and is embedded within an array of relations that go beyond the two individuals concerned. It includes and is constituted by obligations entailed in having kinfolk. In other words, composite and individual personhood cannot be acknowledged or reproduced through the Hindu Marriage Act and Hindu Succession Act, not least like Marshall Saul's law in India is categorizes individual personhood as pre-modern. The subject of Hindu Marriage Act and Succession Act are monadic individuals rather than composite site of social relations. This discrepancy between legal subjectivity and a culturally defined kin category explains why individuals opportunistically assume expeditious or liberal subject positions as litigants and revert to cultural type before and after court appearances or such decision defense. But it also throws light on why 60 years on after these laws were first enacted and equality of status guaranteed as fundamental right against the Constitution, sociological axes of difference such as gender remain mostly undisturbed beyond their former lives, especially in the domain of kinship. The adverse sex ratio and its expanding territory of influence, as recently pointed out, is only but one concrete manifestation of this discrepancy. Now to conclude. In commonplace, in some scholarly understandings of the conflict between law and culture, culture is routinely positioned as a constraining influence, as taking away from people what law has bestowed on them, or in inhibiting their access to these gifts. The public aspirations of laws, especially in the case of India, prevent a routine interrogation of its countervailing force because these aspirations are inherently formulated in the future tense. The promise of equality for all in an undetermined notion of the future, therefore, presents itself as a powerful and, for most part, incontrovertible proposition whose attraction few can deny in a milieu overdetermined by hierarchy. In fact, it is often the functioning or the implementation of law that rather than its content and force, that usually comes for criticism. Injustice, too, is not seen as to issue forth from the nature of law itself in India, but from the indolence or slovenliness of its executors. Only in the event of an explicit challenge fielded by the representative cultural norms, such as the most famously in the case of Shah Bano, or indeed in the current round of cop-inspired violence, is the public aspiration of law tentatively superseded by the question mark placed on its force of law in Indian societies. Cops appear doubly restrictive in this context. Neither are they democratic, that is, neither not based on equality, nor do they defend it. Moreover, their emancipatory potential and their epistemological status is undermined by the fact that cultural norms are not seen to be products of systematic expertise in the way law is, and neither are the recognizable professions attached to them. But it is when we turn the argument on its head that the restrictions placed by law on culture reveal themselves in two forms. One is the ways in which the very, very particular forms of subjectivity find recognition in law, and secondly, how its monadic calculus pairs down relationality. The narrow field of vision for recognition and its politics it gives birth to is well recognized and well noted in scholarship, especially in the case of indigenous communities. Elizabeth Povinelli, amongst others, has discussed at length the gridlocking of indigenous bodies and cultures by the Australian state on two levels, the bestowing of recognition only to the so-called non-repugnant indigenous cultural practices, and secondly, the bestowing of legal recognition only to those that can be demonstrated to have an unbroken continuity with the past. Indigenous communities on their part have been noted to draw on culture as an expedient resource in order to gain recognition from the state. But what we have in the case of the law in India is a very different kind of gridlocking, where culture is rendered anything but expedient. Law is premised on the rupture with the past, and therefore any continuity with the past is precisely what the law cannot address or recognize, especially in matters of ordinary occurrence. In order to re-describe and gain any purchase on the relationship between law and culture, we will therefore need to address both sets of constraints. We will need to address the reasons not for the conflict between law and culture, but following Derrida, for their incommensurability that gives the appearance of hostility. And for that, we will need to examine culture seriously and not just expediently. That is, neither as a resource nor as a gridlock.
Mm.